City, back to the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning, everyone. All right. Our first case of the day, Chicago District Council Carpenters versus Caremark. It's Mr. Ross. Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, I represent the Chicago District Council of Carpenters Welfare Fund. Carpenters is a self-funded plan under ERISA. In 1993, we hired Caremark to act as our pharmaceutical benefits manager for all of our drug benefits programs and plans. We renewed the contract in 1996, entered into a slightly different contract, and then in 2003, we joined a coalition of about 16 other employers and labor unions to enter into a coalition contract with Caremark. Carpenters alleges in this case that Caremark had and exercised discretion in managing its pharmaceutical benefits.
You know, from looking at the redacted contracts, it's really unclear to me how Caremark was being compensated for its services. What I'd like you to explain is how Caremark was paid, because from the looks of the contract, I really don't see how they make money unless they strike a better deal with the drug manufacturers and then pocket the difference.
They are paid a flat fee for every drug, for every prescription they fill. Much like if Blue Cross, if you were self-funded and you worked with Blue Cross, every time a patient went in or any time one of your members would go into the hospital and Blue Cross would administrate the claims, Blue Cross would charge a percentage in those circumstances of the total amount. Under these contracts, it would usually be a flat amount. If you went to your druggist and ordered Lipitor, and the druggist filled that prescription, Caremark would then charge Carpenters a flat fee, a set flat fee, a couple of dollars per prescription. On the mail order prescriptions, they would also charge a flat fee for filling the mail order prescriptions. It was never contemplated, at least by Carpenters, that any part of Caremark's compensation would be in the form of profits or skimming off the deals that they cut with drug manufacturers and the retailers.
The other thing I'm trying to understand is how Caremark Rx is at all involved in any of this, because they don't appear to be a party to any of the contracts, other than the fact that Caremark Inc. is their wholly owned subsidiary. Does Caremark Rx have any connection to the case at all? You know, the complaint seems to treat the two as the same party when they seem to be two different corporations.
With respect to the ERISA claim, you're right, Your Honor. We do treat both as the same party. And maybe we could have been more definitive in the contract. But at this juncture, at this early juncture, we don't know the full relationship between Caremark Rx and Caremark, and we don't know what functions Caremark Rx served with respect to negotiations with drug manufacturers or drug retailers. If they're simply a holding company and that's all they do and they serve no function, perhaps they shouldn't be part of the ERISA claim. But if they do serve a function, and at this point we don't know what function they serve, if they do treat with the manufacturers and the retailers, then yes, they would be acting on our behalf and they would be our ERISA fiduciary. I cited two cases in a footnote, Your Honor, both district court cases, where district courts at the early stage in the pleading said, look, with respect to HMOs, we don't know whether or not we're going to throw out their parent companies. We just don't know at this juncture whether or not the parent company should be in.
The contract itself says that they are not fiduciaries under ERISA. How did that get in, and what does it mean?
I can't answer how that got in other than to tell you that every PBM contract I've ever seen has identical language, be it Caremark, be it Medco, be it any other pharmaceutical benefits manager in the country. The impact, I believe, is nil, that it has no meaning whatsoever.
Why?
Because ERISA precludes it. Because ERISA says that you can't, if you are a functional fiduciary, You can't contract yourself out of that. If you serve...
why is it in the contract?
Probably, and I wasn't there, Your Honor, but probably because Caremark insisted on it.
Well, but there, we really do have sophisticated contracting parties here, don't we? And the language is in there, and if it...
I would...
Saying it's just meaningless. Everybody knows it's unenforceable, is that what you're saying?
I would suggest at the time... that one of the parties wasn't as sophisticated in this area. I would also suggest that these clauses have been stricken down or have been rendered nullities in other areas. And we cite the cases. And this court hasn't been particularly impressed by these kind of exculpatory clauses in plan contracts. You could put the language in there. You could hope that that's the case. And I will tell you, if you look at and I'm slightly off the record, but if you look at the SEC filings of the publicly traded PBMs, you're going to see that, well, we have in all our contracts that we're not fiduciaries, and then telling our shareholders, well, we're not so sure how that's going to hold up, but we don't think we're fiduciaries.
Where in the three contracts would we find language that authorizes Caremark to enter into contracts with drug companies on Carpenter's behalf?
I would suggest that the language that says we will endeavor to negotiate, to use commercially reasonable efforts to negotiate these prices. When in the contracts they use that language and they say, look, we are negotiating. They're negotiating on someone's behalf. They're not
their own.
but they're not saying that. If they're own, if it were their own behalf, they'd use a lot harder efforts than commercially reasonable. They'd use their very best, and it would say so in the contracts. I think that language, and I think that the expectation of the parties from that language, or at least the expectation from Carpenters, is, look, you're our liaison with the retailers. You have this retail network. You're the people that deal with them for us.
And your view is that that's specific enough language to make that happen?
Yes. And I don't know that you need the specific contract language to make that happen. The reality is they're in there negotiating with the retailers. They're telling Carpenters, look, these are the prices we're going to try to get you. We're going to try to get you AWP. There's a blank in the contract, but let me just throw out a random number. AWP minus 15% for brand name drugs and AWP minus, say, 20% for generic drugs. We're going to try to get that for you. If the market changes, we're going to try to get you a better price if the reimbursement rates go down. If we lose pharmacies from the network, we're going to try to get you we're going to charge you a higher price. And at all times, they're saying, we're going in to set this pricing structure. At that point, whose behalf are they acting on? They're not buying drugs. They're not buying a penny's worth of drugs from the retailers. We're buying the drugs from the retailers. They could only be acting on our behalf.
Now, of course, the fund also gets partial reimbursement of manufacturers' rebates, doesn't it?
Correct. Under the contract, there is a set amount of rebates that come in. It varies from contract to contract. It continues to get higher and higher between the three contracts. We would get, say, $1.50 per brand name prescription filled by the mail order, by the mail order process, and say a dollar per generic at the end of the year. That's, first of all, only to the extent that Caremark itself is getting rebates from the manufacturers, and they have the option, they have the discretion to get their incentives in other forms than rebates, and we believe that they do that. But in addition, there's all kinds of other money there. That doesn't say this is all you're going to get. That just says we're going to promise you this to the extent that we're getting rebates. There, when the pharmaceutical benefits manager, when Caremark treats with the drug manufacturers, there's all kinds of rebate money or incentive money or education grants or free samples, all kinds of forms of payments back to Caremark to favor their various drugs in the formulary decisions. And that money's coming back to Caremark. And at that point, Caremark, the contract's silent as to where that money goes. Completely silent. Caremark, at that point, has discretion what to do with that money. And we believe that it abuses discretion by looking to its own self-interest, by putting that money in its pocket. And this is a classic fiduciary breach case, whether under common law or under ERISA, which basically just follows the common law and breach of fiduciary duty law. This is a classic case when you're talking about making decisions on behalf of one person while being influenced by a third party. When a carpenter's member walks in and needs a cholesterol-lowering drug, and his physician says, you know, I like Lipitor, I'm going to prescribe you Lipitor. And the
Are you getting a kickback from Lipitor?
Am I getting a kickback?
It's the only drug you've mentioned.
It's on my morning diet, Your Honor, I'm sorry to say.
You should take it at night, but go ahead.
Really? I think we mentioned Zocor in that as well, but that is an example. You see all kinds of examples with the patent-protected drugs. In fact, the First Circuit, in the very case that Caremark talks about, that recent case out of the First Circuit where the PBM's trade association was challenging this new Maine statute requiring disclosure, First Circuit says, look, they're in a great position in drug switching. And by the way, drug switching is not a pejorative term. It's not like they're doing something wrong. Drug switching is a money-saving facet of the plan that we hire them to manage. And when they go in, they're under all kinds of ability to be influenced in their drug switching decisions. Now, I think the First Circuit had it wrong slightly. The First Circuit thought that they would actually be switching from generics to brand names. In reality, they'd switch between one patent-protected brand name to another. That would be such a huge breach on such a huge scale if you switch from a 50-cent generic to a $5 brand name. That would be entirely outrageous and I think banned by many state laws.
I have just a litigation history question. After the dismissal of the ERISA claim in this case, you filed an amended complaint?
Yes, Your Honor.
As I understand it, and that amended complaint asserted only state law claims?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, the first thing we did was renumbered the complaint properly so it wasn't as confusing as the last complaint. But it only alleged the breach of contract claim and the violation of the Illinois Deceptive Business Practices Act claim. There were counts 2 and 3 of the original claim.
So why shouldn't that be construed as an abandonment of the ERISA claim?
We looked at that. We looked at that very issue. And so long as the court has dismissed the federal cause of action and you've gotten a ruling on that, then it's not an abandonment of that claim to bring the pendant claim separately. And in fact, some courts have deemed it contemptuous if you reallege the same complaint that it's already dismissed. So we did not, we assured ourselves that we were preserving the claim for appeal and that we were not going to anger Judge Dara unnecessarily by flouting his decision, throwing the ERISA claim out.
Are you still in state court on that contract?
Yes, we are, Your Honor.
What's the status of that?
Caremark filed a motion to dismiss. It's fully briefed, pending argument. What we do with the state court claim, assuming that this court, and I don't want to be presumptuous, but assuming that this court reverses Judge Darrow's decision, is still up in the air. With that all said, Your Honors, unless you have any other questions, I'll save the remaining time I have for rebuttal.
Thank you. Mr. Ross.
May it please the Court. My name is Rob Griffith. I represent the defendants in this case, Caremark Rx, Inc. and Caremark, Inc. This is not an ERISA case. At best, this is a contract dispute between two sophisticated entities. ERISA was never meant to be utilized and should not be allowed to be utilized to override and rewrite the terms of a contract, third-party service contracts in this case, that two sophisticated parties agreed to. None of the allegations in plaintiff's complaint, nor any of the litany of new arguments made for the first time here on appeal, evidence or would support an argument that Caremark was either acting as a fiduciary under ERISA or was acting in a fiduciary capacity when taking the actions that are subject of the complaint.
Mr. Griffith, what should we make of this language in the contracts requiring Caremark to use commercially reasonable efforts to negotiate rates with existing pharmacies in Carpenter's network? I mean, that sort of indicates that Carpenter's was treating Caremark like its agent or fiduciary for that purpose. No?
Not at all. As the district court properly found, the retail, you're talking about the single sentence in the provision of each contract in the as far as what drugs dispensed by retail pharmacies. And the contracts make very clear that Caremark is charging the plan, and the plan is agreeing to pay Caremark fixed prices for the retail drugs dispensed via Caremark's retail pharmacy network. Now, the language that you referenced, as the district court properly found, is akin to a force majeure clause, that it allows for a price increase in the event that there are uncontrollable or unforeseen changes in the marketplace. There, in that situation, there can be a price adjustment. Now, obviously, plaintiff argues that it should be interpreted more broadly than that, that it should also be read to impose upon Caremark an obligation to also reduce prices in the event the marketplace were to allow it. But even if either way you read the provision, there is no discretion being afforded. If an adjustment is called for, then an adjustment should be made. And there's no discretion being afforded to Caremark in that process. If Carpenter's believes that an adjustment should have been made and that its prices, its fixed prices that it agreed to should be adjusted accordingly, and it believes that was not done, then it has a contract claim. And in response to Justice Sykes' question, that contract claim is...
She used to be Justice Sykes. Now she's Judge Sykes.
My apologies. Judge Sykes. Yeah, I should know that by now. Judge Sykes' point, that claim has been made and is pending in state court. And it's also telling that at the federal court level, when plaintiff first filed his complaint here before this court, it never cited to the adjustment language as evidencing any kind of discretion. That allegation was in support of its breach of contract claim pending here in federal court. And in support of that claim, even Carpenter's argued that didn't afford Caremark any discretion in pricing. It created an obligation. And according to Carpenter's, that obligation was breached, therefore a breach of contract. If their interpretation is correct, which we submit that it's not, it's of no event because, again, at best, it's a contract claim.
Well, but you argue that the Caremark... Carpenter's contracts demonstrate Caremark negotiates separate prices to be charged to each of its customers. What provisions in each of the three contracts will demonstrate that?
The provisions in the contracts that would reference that would be the retail pricing provisions, that the fixed retail pricing provisions and the mail order pricing provisions evidenced the specific fixed price that this customer, Carpenter's, negotiated with Caremark. I want to also back up, unless you want to, if you need further follow up on that another point. Judge Evans made a asked the question of my opposing counsel as to the impact or the import of the language in the contract whereby both parties agreed that Carpenter's at all times maintained complete control over this contract. And not surprisingly, Carpenter's wants to walk away from that provision, and I think their position today is that it has no merit whatsoever. But again, as the district court properly found, it does have merit. Again, you can be a under ERISA, the ERISA defines an entity as a fiduciary with respect to an ERISA plan if it has invested with any discretionary authority or responsibility in the administration of the plan, or it exercises discretion or control over the management of the plan or its assets. Carpenter's has alleged both They've alleged that, that Caremark is both vested with authority and that they exercise it. As the contract language that Judge Evans pointed out makes clear, Caremark is not vested with contractual discretion or authority over the plan. And the not one of the contracts contains any discretionary functions. They each explicitly state that Carpenters retain sole and complete authority and control to administer the plan, and that Caremark is not to be construed, is not considered an ERISA fiduciary in that regard.
You know, Carpenters posed an interesting hypothetical on pages 13 to 14 of the reply brief. Do you have that there with you regarding, you know, the preferred to the non-preferred drug and Caremark having the discretion to try and persuade doctors?
That relates to one of the three arguments they made as to why, despite not being vested with contractual discretion or authority, Caremark exercises some discretion in the management or administration of the plan. That argument related to that Caremark has considerable influence or discretion in the management of its formulary in drug switching or therapeutic interchange programs. And the again, the district court was correct in finding that no, the plan, the implementation of a therapeutic interchange program is a plan design feature. Council admitted that Carpenters adopted and implemented the therapeutic interchange program as part of its plan design. Plan design decisions like that are exempt from fiduciary review. In the execution, and this example relates to the execution of such a therapeutic interchange or a drug switch, as they call it. And again, that is not Caremark's decision. Carpenters alleges in the in its briefs that Caremark has, I think their words were, the sole responsibility of deciding whether to persuade a member's health care provider to switch a prescription. That is simply not correct. And this example that you cite is an example of their allegation of Caremark's decision to make that kind of a switch.
Am I off the wall if I think that the way Caremark makes money is to make deals with manufacturers and keep the savings rather than passing savings on to the fund?
You're not off the wall at all, Your Honor. You've just read the contracts. That's precisely what they provide. This is not a pass-through situation as counsel represents. There are two somewhat beyond the purposes of today, but there are two business models in large part out there, a pass-through situation where a plan will be charged an administrative fee, a claims processing fee for every claim tendered. They'll charge a set fee, and then they'll pass through their cost, their drugs at cost. You'll see from these contracts there's no administrative fee charged.
So is that self-dealing, or does it matter for ERISA purposes even if it is self-dealing?
Caremark is not an ERISA fiduciary, and its negotiation with its own suppliers is for its own account. It's not related to an ERISA plan at all, so there is no self-dealing implication in that situation. And to wrap up the formulary and the therapeutic interchange programs, that is, as the contract language makes clear, it is not Caremark that decides to make or to try and persuade a prescriber to effect a switch. The contract says explicitly, the provisions, the very provisions counsel quoted in his papers, that Caremark, quote, shall contact prescribers as appropriate to obtain approval for substitution of formulary drugs. That's shall. There's no discretion there. Caremark has to. Carpenters made the plan design decision to implement therapeutic interchange programs.
It doesn't impact on this case, but in 2006, is Caremark still doing business with the Carpenters Union?
I think effective January 1, 2006, they are no longer doing business together. But So at the end of the day, on the formulary compliance, it is Carpenters who controls it, Carpenters who decides whether or not to implement it, and Carpenters who decides whether to turn these switches on or turn these switches off. If they're on, Caremark has to affect them as the contract provides. If they're off, then it's not appropriate. Caremark doesn't try to affect them. And they're also, it's not a little point. Any switch would ultimately be the ultimate decision-making authority, which is obviously important in the ERISA fiduciary context, ultimately resides with the prescribing physician who makes the decision whether or not he's going to make that change or not. So as far as formulary compliance, as far as therapeutic interchange, the ultimate decision-making authority, which is critical as to whether or not one's an ERISA fiduciary, either rests with the plan, Carpenters, and its trustees, or the prescribing physician. In no circumstance does it reside with Caremark. I want to address, in my time remaining, a couple of the new arguments that plaintiff has made for the first time on appeal. As we've said in our paper...
Well, if it's the first time on appeal, aren't they waived?
That's our position. I believe that's the correct position. They've made the argument since this case is up before the panel on a Rule 12b-6 dismissal that the court should be lenient and consider new allegations, new factual allegations, citing this court's decision in Highsmith and the related its related progeny. But where that fails is that the new theories they have made do not relate to the theories alleged in the complaint, and therefore they are waived. As this court's decision that just came down a couple of months ago in the County of McHenry versus Insurance Company of the West case, the injection of new theories at the appellate level is entirely inappropriate. But even if they were to be considered, they are not sufficient. They do not support Caremark exercising discretion over the administration or management of the plan. The primary new argument they make is that the selection of the AWP source in the administrative contracts is somehow a discretionary function. They cite the provision in the contracts that say Caremark can pull the AWP from either First Data Bank or some other nationally reported service of pharmaceutical prices. Importantly, though they say that's an evidence of discretion, they never allege that it's ever been abused. So even if it were true, it wouldn't support any breach of fiduciary duty claim. They never claim that Caremark chose to select a higher AWP. They simply allege that evidence is some sort of discretion. But it doesn't. Because the allegation that Caremark, the AWP provision they reference is contained in Carpenters and Caremark contracts. It's not the plan documents. Caremark's compliance with the terms of its service contracts hardly evidences exercising any discretion on behalf of the plan. If anything, it relates to the administration of services Caremark is providing. But moreover, by plaintiff's own admission, the most they can allege is that Caremark precisely complied with the terms of the negotiated contracts. And as this court's decision in Shulist and the Ed Miniat versus Globe Life Insurance case, compliance adherence to contractually negotiated terms cannot support a breach of fiduciary duty claim. At the end of the day, this is a contract negotiated, or three contracts negotiated, between two sophisticated parties. There's no discretion vested in Caremark in those contracts, and there were no allegations in the complaint below that would support Caremark exercising any such discretion. Accordingly, the district court properly dismissed this case.
Thank you, Mr. Griffin. Mr. Ross, how much time? Minute and a half.
I'll speak quickly, Your Honor. First off, I think I should point out that ERISA sets the threshold on whether or not a party is a fiduciary extremely low. Counsel said it requires discretion. The language under ERISA is any discretion. Either you have any discretion under the contract, whether or not you exercise it, or you exercise any discretion, whether or not the contract grants you the discretion. Now, with respect to the formulary compliance, We do allege, and Caremark never denies, and has never shied away from that in its brief, that the drug manufacturers pay the PBM incentives to make certain decisions. Well, if all these were ministerial acts, as Caremark would have the court believe, then why on earth would the drug manufacturers pay Caremark simply for rubber stamping? The only reason to give incentives is to give an incentive to Caremark. I almost made a verb out of that, incentivize, is to give Caremark the incentive to choose its drugs. Choice is, by definition, discretion. Judge Evans, you requested the language from ERISA that precludes these kind of exculpatory, or I assume you would want the language from ERISA that precludes these kind of exculpatory clauses that Caremark has been trying to hide behind, and that would be found at section 1110 parentheses little a of ERISA that totally bans those kinds of agreements. I see my time has run out. I had two more points to make, but
if you could make them in a minute, make them.
Counsel also talked about drug switching to be compulsory under the contracts. Keeps omitting the language when appropriate. The decision of when a drug switch is appropriate is completely up to Caremark, not up to Carpenters. Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, the case will be taken under advisement.